Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, humanity's need for energy is taxing us in ways we sometimes don't realize. Ozone-depleting gases are being phased out, and smugglers are taking advantage of the higher prices, but alternatives have arrived. In many parts of the world, the need for firewood is threatening every tree. Now, low technology is helping people cook with the sun. Some nuclear power plants are being shut down, and we'll pay for it every time we turn on the lights. And we're consumed by mosquitoes in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. A lot of human effort goes into harnessing energy. In the developing world, some folks spend days on end searching for firewood to cook with. Industrialized nations pour enormous amounts of money into generating and controlling energy. The methods and substances we use for energy influence the environment. We'll look at some of the impacts. Cooling. Either to store food or keep our homes comfortable takes energy and coolants. Since the 1930s, we've used CFCs for refrigerators and air conditioning. But CFCs erode the Earth's protective ozone layer, even though they were touted as wonder chemicals. Today, they face a worldwide phase-out. The most widely known CFC is called Freon. Because of the phase-out, the price of Freon has skyrocketed, opening the door for alternatives which are less harmful. But some environmentalists fear that Freon smuggling and disagreement over which new substance is best may threaten progress made on eliminating ozone-depleting gases. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally reports.
If you've recently had to buy a new refrigerator or get your air conditioner charged, you probably know all about the global phase-out of ozone-depleting gases. 1996 signaled the start of new laws which will slowly wean us of our appetite for Freon and other compounds which are contributing to ozone depletion. Although these gases are no longer produced for developing nations, there's still a lot of it around, and the dwindling supply has meant a big increase in price. The big money in Freon has led to smuggling, which by some accounts is second only in South Florida to the smuggling in illegal drugs. John Pasacantando is with Ozone Action. He says smuggling has the potential of knocking the planned phase-out off course.
It's one of the critical links, and if this link falls out of the chain, it'll mean that all so many other very important efforts to protect the ozone layer will be for naught. And if you look at ozone depletion right now, we're seeing record levels of depletion over the South Pole in the Antarctic, where the ozone hole traditionally is, but we're also seeing severe depletion like has never been recorded before or expected over the northern hemisphere, over the populated parts of the globe.
But while smuggling is a problem, U.S. law enforcement officials are working to catch the criminals. Last month, the Justice Department brought the largest environmental excise tax case ever against three people charged with smuggling more than 4,000 tons of Freon into the United States. Tom Fitzgerald is the assistant U.S. attorney in Florida. He says the 164-count indictment is typical of cases of Freon smuggling.
The indictments in these cases normally have conspiracy charges, which is sort of a criminal partnership count. They typically have smuggling charges because the material is illegally entered into the United States, which is just another way of saying smuggled. There are, in at least half the cases, tax evasion counts. And in some of the cases, we have had money laundering charges because the illegal proceeds of the sale of this material is laundered. And we've also had bribery and obstruction of justice counts where individuals have tried to persuade witnesses not to cooperate or not to tell the truth to a grand jury.
Fitzgerald says it's next to impossible to know which Freon is legal and which is illegal once it has left the port. This means big profits for the smugglers and price gouging for consumers.
If the price is kept close to the legitimate market price, your local auto air conditioner repair facility would have no way of knowing whether what they were buying was legal or illegally in the country.
So it's also quite possible for a consumer to go to a repair shop and wind up with illegal Freon in their tank.
I'm afraid so. In fact, it's often the subject of discussion among the agents and myself about which of us may be driving around with smuggled Freon in our auto air conditioners.
Fitzgerald says everyone in his office has switched to one of two Freon alternatives, but those compounds have problems of their own. The first is HCFC, which still depletes the ozone layer, but much less so than Freon. The other is HFC, which is not an ozone depleter, but is an extremely potent greenhouse gas. Hillary French is with the World Watch Institute. She says the best alternative, HC, has been kept out of the U.S. market.
In terms of HCFCs and HFCs, the chemical industry has invested very heavily in both of these, over $1 billion, I believe, was one of the latest estimates. So, you know, they definitely have a strong interest in seeing that they recoup these very large investments that they've made in these technologies. HCs, on the other hand, hydrocarbons, have not been promoted by the chemical industry. Instead, they've tended to be promoted by quite small companies. The leading example for domestic refrigeration is a technology called Green Freeze that was developed by Greenpeace, actually, in Germany originally.
Right now, products using HCs are not available in the U.S. Appliance manufacturers here have spent years designing highly energy-efficient appliances which use HFCs. They argue the efficiency offsets the greenhouse effect of the HFCs. But French says the demand for products which use coolants is exploding, and the most benign technology, the HCs, should be the standard.
We need to accelerate our response to ozone depletion, and because we need to get serious about doing something about climate change.
And as far as the use of refrigerants is concerned worldwide, where is it headed?
It's going up pretty dramatically, particularly in the developing world, of course, where the demand for consumer goods like refrigerators is skyrocketing. Understandably, as countries develop, that's one of the first things people want, is some way of storing food.
If all this talk about coolants is getting you dizzy, you don't have much to worry about. Although Europe is making a transition to HCs, the one compound that is neither ozone-depleting or a greenhouse gas, it's not available in the U.S. Refrigerators and air conditioning systems will likely change as the phase-out continues, but for now, consumers don't have many choices. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. Or you can listen to us via the Internet. Go to our new webpage at www.enn.com/envshow and click on Listen to the Environment Show. That's www.enn.com/envshow. In the near term, cooking with the sun may be one of the most important applications of solar energy. Environmentalists talk about solar energy until your eyes glaze over. They describe passive solar with exotic heat storage materials and roofing shingles with built-in photovoltaic cells. For them, it's a world of high-tech gizmos that the affluent adventurer can play with to beat the utility company. But the solar cooker makes her stove out of a cardboard box with some aluminum foil, or some stiff material covered with foil and a plastic bag, or bamboo and dung shaped into a parabolic dish. It's about as low-tech as you can get. But the environmental significance of solar cooking for a huge proportion of the Earth's population could be tremendous.
There's a growing problem in many parts of the world today where wood is becoming very scarce, and it's the primary means of cooking daily meals for a lot of families. It's estimated by the UN organizations that one-third of the families on this planet already are suffering fuel wood shortages. And this adds a lot of burdens to people who are already having a hard time surviving.
That was Bev Bloom, executive director of Solar Cookers International, a small educational nonprofit group devoted to promoting solar cooking to benefit people and the environment worldwide. Solar Cookers has developed a new cooker which they find to be particularly effective.
Our volunteers have developed a new, very simple device, which we're very excited about. It's a simple open panel, which can be made from something as simple as cardboard and a bit of aluminum foil, and a plastic bag, and you can cook family meals with it. And it's simple enough so I could look at yours and say, gee, I could make one of those myself.
Solar Cookers has projects in the Dob refugee camp in Kenya and has recently been funded by UNESCO to run two projects in Zimbabwe. Typically, they train about 50 people who are then expected to train others. In parts of Zimbabwe, about one quarter of a family's income is spent on fuel wood. Solar cooking can improve the standard of living and alleviate the relentless pressure constant wood gathering puts on the landscape. Bloom says solar cooking is particularly important in refugee camps.
These refugees are put off in very remote, very fragile environments where there are just nothing to work with. And there are many cases where people may get some meager food rations, but if they don't have fuel to cook it with, then they have to barter away part of their food to get the fuel to cook the rest of it.
Getting people to accept solar cooking is another challenge. One analyst writing for the Journal of Technology Studies branded the Solar Cookers International efforts in Lesotho in southern Africa a failure because the solar boxes were being introduced and given away by well-meaning foreigners. Nevertheless, solar cooking does work. You can try it yourself. Solar Cooking International sells a book with all of the details about making and using cookers from cardboard and aluminum foil. They can be reached on the web. Search for Solar Cookers International. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, a nuclear plant in Connecticut is closing. It signals the beginning of the end for nuclear power, which is just too expensive. Photographer Robert Glenn Ketchum brings us a portrait of the whole world. And we're consumed by mosquitoes in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. An economic analysis commissioned by the owners of the Connecticut Yankee Atomic Power Plant in Haddam Neck, Connecticut, has just been completed. The analysis concluded that the continued operation of the plant was not in the best interests of the owner companies nor of their consumers. That's corporate gobbledygook for saying that the plant needs to be shut down, otherwise everyone is going to go broke.
The potential loss to our joint owners and subsequent customers in the best case scenarios over the next 10 years, which is what we have left on our operating license, would have been a break-even. The worst case could have gone to a $100 million loss. If we had extended outages and poor runs, it just isn't economical to continue to operate.
That was Tony Noriccio, spokesman for the Connecticut Yankee plant. He emphasized that the cost of the presently needed repairs was not the determining factor. Instead, it's the high cost of nuclear power generally, in a market which is being deregulated, and electricity can be made far more cheaply using fuels like natural gas. You might think that shutting down a power plant that's too expensive to operate and substituting cheaper electricity will save the consumer or ratepayer some money. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. When the plant was built in 1967, it cost about $100 million. Decommissioning the plant in 1997 will cost $423 million. Noriccio describes how that cost will be met.
We have a fund that we've been collecting from ratepayers, our joint owners have, and that's funded to the tune of approximately $190 million in a reserve trust.
The difference between the $423 million decommissioning cost and the $190 million reserve will be paid for by you and me, the consumer. Yankee will buy cheap power elsewhere, sell it for the same price they are getting for the high-cost nuclear power, and apply the difference to the decommissioning and nuclear fuel storage costs. It appears that the collapse of the Yankee nuclear plant will be repeated elsewhere. David Moskowitz, director of the Regulatory Assistance Project and former Public Utility Commissioner for the state of Maine, says economic competition will probably close a significant proportion of the nation's nuclear plants.
Well, I think there's a fairly significant part of the nuclear industry, and maybe as much as a quarter of the existing plants, that probably would not cut it in a competitive environment. And depending on where they're located in the country, how fast those areas, those regions, or those states are turning to a competitive market for power will probably dictate how quickly that sort of part of the nuclear industry ends up shutting down prematurely.
Moskowitz confirms that the cost of decommissioning and the cost of storage of nuclear waste, which will probably stretch out for generations, will be paid for by users of electricity as far into the future as we can imagine. Consumer reaction is predictable.
It will make a lot of people very angry.
Thus, it appears that the age of the nuclear power plants is coming to an end. And the thing that's killing off the atomic behemoths is not issues of the environment or safety, but plain old dollars and cents. The problem is we may be paying the cost of the nuclear generating adventure through higher electricity bills for generations. We all have places which are special to us. They could be city streets or places deep in the wilderness. Robert Glenn Ketchum is the author of Northwest Passage, a book of photography published by Aperture. His special place is the whole world. On today's show, we've told you about environmental challenges from the U.S. to Kenya. Ketchum believes a problem in one place affects everywhere else. He says he's awed looking at the world as a whole and feels fortunate to be one of its citizens.
I am a writer and a photographer whose career has been blessed with the opportunity to travel the world. From Africa to Alaska, the poles to the equator, Russia, China, India, Indonesia, each has presented me with something entirely different, and all have left me wanting to return for more. I'm often asked, what in all of the traveling is my favorite place? And without hesitation, I always answer, Earth. Beyond any question of a doubt in my mind, this planet is the most astonishing location in the known universe, and I can hardly wait to wake up in the morning and enjoy wherever I am and whatever the day presents me. From the miniature gardens of alpine mountaintops to the fertile, food-rich valley floors, from the sparity of deserts to the extravagant lushness of an old-growth rainforest, from the height of the blue-blue sky to the bottom of the deepest sea where fish produce their own neon light, I know intuitively, as one of the creatures blessed by being here, that there is nothing like this place anywhere else. Our space probes may have found signs of life on neighboring planets, but from what we presently know, these few primitive forms pale by comparison to the profusion of life we experience as Earth inhabitants. Perhaps more importantly, those probes into space have afforded us a rare opportunity to look back upon ourselves and consider our world, our home. Those pictures show a tiny planet floating in the vastness of the universe, radiantly beautiful as the blue of the prolific oceans sparkles through the precious clouded atmosphere that supports and protects us all. Magnificent, we sparkle like a jewel against the black void of infinite space. Nothing else we have discovered so far comes even close, and we discover more about this place each day. The closer we look, the greater the richness seems to be. Regardless of where or to what minute degree our inspection takes, we find fantastic living things have adapted to every single niche and cranny. All of these other creatures are our lifelines, our support system, and if we disrespect their contribution, the poorer our existence will be because of it. These other living organisms are our considerable friends and neighbors. From the dragonfly to the pachyderm, welcome to our herd. Welcome to our family. Tied by the bonds of air, water, and the circumference of this globe, this place is our life, and with it, its diversity are those upon whom we will depend and with whom we will pass the time. Each one's presence is critical to some other presence, and the divisions of genus and species completely fail to describe the wonder of all the differences, a biodiversity perhaps unmatched in the entire universe. That view from space also makes it clear that we are a finite and fragile system, and there does not seem to be any immediate help in the near vicinity if we breach the protection of it and precipitate our own demise. May we never be in such a hurry to serve ourselves that we take for granted the greater world which supports us all. May we never fail to recognize how extraordinary it is. As light comes into the world and gives color to it, as flowers bloom out and trees rustle in the breeze, as butterflies float by and fish swim shimmeringly through, as fall comes to the deciduous forests and snow dusts the mountain summits, we should stand in awe of our good fortune of being here. Complex beyond human imagination, if there ever was a Garden of Eden, this is it.
Robert Glenn Ketchum is author of Northwest Passage, published by Aperture. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Last week, 14 inches of rain fell on Brownsville, Texas, along the Rio Grande River. That incredible deluge ended a drought that has been 8 months in the making. Karen Chapman is director of the Sable Palm Grove Wildlife Sanctuary for the National Audubon Society. It's located on the Rio Grande riverbank on the southernmost piece of land in the continental United States. She says the rain has had an immediate impact.
The mosquitoes, which had been waiting, you know, for 9 months, just also exploded in population. And we're really, really getting overrun with them right now. A lot of people are complaining. And so cities are going around spraying to reduce the risk of mosquito-borne diseases like dengue fever, which we had an outbreak of a couple of years ago here. And they are unfortunately using malathion, which also kills beneficial insects. So we've got some positive and negative things coming from this flooding.
Now, I presume all of the insects probably look pretty good to some migrating birds. So what happened there?
Yeah, we had right after the rains, and of course they brought heavy winds, and a lot of the migrating species of warblers were brought down by that. And here in the sanctuary, the day after the rain, we were just, you know, inundated not only with water but with warblers everywhere. We had, you know, red starts and hooded warblers and black-throated greens and blackburnians everywhere in the trees, and we're just, you know, going nuts with all of the insects around.
The sanctuary has the largest and oldest tract of sable palms left in the country. It's about 50 acres. The rain has brought an immediate response from the trees.
When we get a rain like this, which pretty much constitutes almost 80% of our entire rain for the year, they will certainly take advantage of that. And I expect to see them, you know, grow, put out new leaves here. And a lot of them are already. Some of the palms that had fallen down in the forest and I thought were dead have actually sprouted new leaves as a result of this flood. So they're, you know, taking off again, just taking advantage of the water.
So the rains came, mosquitoes are buzzing, the palms are sprouting, and the warblers are falling out of the sky in the Rio Grande floodplain. If I were a Texan making this Earth Calendar a Texas-sized tall tale, I would tell you that Noah's event was nothing more than a heavy dew in comparison to this flood. The mosquitoes are the size of vultures, the warblers are the size of eagles, and this is the greatest radio show ever broadcast in the history of humankind. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for show number 355. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.